Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to Millennial Love, a podcast from The Independent on everything to do with love, sexuality, identity and more. This week I spoke to the lovely author and journalist Natasha Lunn. Natasha runs the popular newsletter called Conversations on Love, for which she interviews authors, celebrities and a wide range of experts all about love, dating and relationships. We discuss her new book of the same name, which features interviews with the likes of Roxane Gay and Alain de Botton. And given that our books came out within a week of one another, we actually talk about both hers and my book, in addition to the complexities of writing about your own love life, the expectations placed on mothers to fall in love at first sight with their newborns, and why both of us spent the better part of a decade fantasizing over someone we never properly dated. Enjoy! Hi Natasha, how are you?
Hi Olivia, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming. I'm so excited to chat to you. So your book, I think, will be out the day or the day after this comes out. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've my baby's been sick and she gave it to me last week. So I haven't really had time to get too worried or anxious about it because I've just been up every half an hour through the night. So in a strange way, it's been a blessing because I think otherwise I would be a lot more nervous. But I've just been mopping up temperature and sweat and having her like snot all over me.
Oh god, how old is she?
She's 9 months.
Oh sweet,
she's great. And so yeah, no, but I am really excited. It's just you know, all the cliches about a juggler true, trying to do everything at once is funny.
It's a lot. There's so much that I want to talk to you about. As you know, I have been a fan of Conversations on Love, the newsletter, since it started. So for those who aren't aware of it or don't subscribe to it, can you start off by explaining a bit what made you want to launch that? Because obviously that's what the book has come from. So what made you want to launch that newsletter? What do you think drew you to kind of examining the subject of love in that way in the first place?
I answer this question a lot of different ways because I think originally I used to always say, oh, we each have our questions in life. And, you know, this was mine that I wanted to find out more about love. But I think we're all obsessed with love. I think all of us have that fascination from the very beginning. And I think for me, it was two things. It was realizing by the time I fell in romantic love when I was in my 30s, how much I had misunderstood about love and what it really was, and how all the things that I was longing for and looking for and hoping for had very little to do with being in a long-term relationship with another person. And so almost just getting that feeling of like, how have I got this so wrong for so long? Where did that begin? Where did I get all those ideas about love and obsession and longing from? And being just fascinated in how I got to that point, really. And then another part of it was just understanding how narrow my view of love had been, seeing it just as romantic love. And I think that there's lots of books and stories out there saying we need to not focus too much on romantic love and we need to, you know, focus on friendship, focus on everything else. But I had definitely found those conversations in context of being single. So saying, you know, you shouldn't obsess over finding a romantic relationship. You should also value your friends and family. And then what I realized is actually, no, that is just as important when you are in a relationship. You know, even when I had met my husband and fallen in love, for that relationship to succeed, I understood how important it was not to load all my expectation for happiness onto him, and to just keep investing in all those other different relationships in my life. So I kind of came to the newsletters being like, right, how do I do this? How do I make sure that I am continuing to learn and try love and prioritize it, given that I don't want to spend the next decade overlooking it as I did the decade before.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's so interesting about the idea of love being so different when you're in it to how you are conditioned to think about it. Because for me, it was exactly the same. And it's really funny because I started the podcast and started this kind of like, you know, talking about love on a regular basis and thinking about it. Not that I hadn't been doing that already, but in a professional capacity. And again, it wasn't until I was in a relationship, like a long-term relationship, that I realized this is completely different to everything I thought it was going to be. And actually, it just makes you realize the way that we're reared to think about love and romance and intimacy is just completely different to the reality. And I think that is changing thanks to newsletters and, you know, people like you who write about this stuff and the reality of it and talk to such fascinating people. I mean, my God, you've spoken to so many interesting people for the newsletter and the book. Is there anyone in particular that you feel like a conversation just completely changed something that felt really personal to you about the way that you thought about your own love life?
I think about so many of the lessons in the conversations all the time, because I'm sure, as you found, Olivia, you can learn about this stuff so much, and then it's even worse because you find yourself making the mistake and then you're like, oh, I'm doing this again. And even like the other night, my husband and I hadn't really slept, and I was like, well, you had 2 hours sleep, and he's like, well, you had 3.5. And there was a therapist who said to me, like, competition is the enemy of a relationship. Like, if you both try and win, you both lose. That's like the only time in a relationship that happens. So little things, little lessons like that, and the Gottman stuff about bids for attention, and when your partner is saying, you know, I've read this article today, I want to tell you about it, and not like scrolling through Instagram on your phone, just looking at them and actually engaging with it, little stuff like that. But I think on a bigger sense, something like the writer Sarah Hoppola said to me, so she wants to find a romantic relationship, she hasn't yet, and part of the conversation is her realizing that she's got this amazing love story with her parents, and also with her writing, and just learning to see love in a more expansive way as well. And she said to me that she's realized that there's always going to be this low rattle of unhappiness. So for her, it was like when she was single, she had this low rattle of unhappiness, not knowing if she would ever find love. But then there might be that about something else if she did. And she kind of said this thing to me that perhaps like the low rattle of unhappiness is just part of what it means to be alive. Mm. And I was thinking about this because part of the reason that I wrote the book is wanting to explore the parallels between looking for romantic love in my 20s and then trying to get pregnant in my 30s, and how I long for this romantic relationship and then I found it, and then I'm like longing for the next thing and completely overlooking this thing that I spent 2 decades searching for. And I've come to realize that I'm sort of made peace with the fact that there will always be that thing that you're longing for, or that what she calls the low rattle of unhappiness, or something that you feel is missing, or something you feel frustrated by. And it's more about acknowledging that and not letting it distract you too much from everything else, rather than trying to find a life where there's no low rattle, because I think it's always going to be there. So there's like lots of bigger things like that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Someone, I did a Reiki course once in Ibiza, and someone said to me, the Reiki person said, and you know, I don't know if you know how Reiki works or for listeners, but you know, I went into this room, it was a tent actually, and I didn't really chat to this woman, but she kind of told me to lie down on this bed and kind of blew like ashes all over me and sage and felt my energy as they do. And then we had a chat and she kind of talked to me about the things that she discovered. And it was really weird. She kind of picked up on all of this stuff. She knew I was a writer. She knew all the stuff about my family. And one thing she said to me, and this was like maybe 6 years ago, she said, there's a sadness in your heart. And I think I've spoken about this on the podcast before. And it was brutal, right? And so you hear something like that, and I've spent years trying to work out, what is this sadness in my heart? And like, I pick it up to different things, like blame my father, blame this boyfriend, blame this person. But it resonates with what you said about that rattle, because it's like, there's always a part of you that's going to feel somehow like there's something missing, or that there's something that you're longing for, like you said.
Or a fear, you know?
Yeah.
I have it all the time now, you know, obviously part of the book is longing for a baby, but now I have so many fears about my daughter all the time. And I have just learned that love is not a spotless experience. And actually, hopefully, by lining up all these conversations and showing sort of the many different joys and the many different problems, now when something does come up for me that's a bit difficult, I just am more peaceful about it, I think. Because I just remember that it's arrogant to think that I can be here and not have any struggle or sadness or suffering.
Yeah, totally. You're right. It is quite arrogant. And I think the more we can recognize that, the better. God, there's so much I want to talk to you about. But I guess I'll start with, you know, there are quite a lot of parallels in terms of our experiences of love. You know, obviously, you're in your 30s, I'm in my 20s. But I think in terms of what you went through in your 20s and what I'm going through right now or have been through. So I want to talk to you about how you start the book. You start by talking about someone called Ben, who ended up being a 15-year long crush for you. So if I'm right in thinking, that takes you from 14 to 29?
Yes.
So talk to me.
Yeah, it was
13.
13 to 29. Yeah,
I am so fascinated by this because, as you know, in my book, I talk about someone who I was kind of infatuated and obsessed with for 8 or 9 years, maybe longer, probably longer than that. I just wanted to dumb it down.
I know. As I was saying, I was like, was it 30?
Yeah. So talk to me about this person you call Ben. Who was he, and why do you think you spent so long kind of pining after him?
Well, like you, I found it really interesting reading about Jack, because I think you said at the end, like, you still don't, you're kind of in touch and you check in, but you still don't know really what it was. And as I was writing, there's a line in the end of it. And I said, you know, do I keep wanting to waste time on this nostalgic crush? And originally I had nostalgic friendship. And then I was like, there's not really a word for what that was. It started out as a teenage obsession, you know, boyfriend, and however, you know, relationship when you're a teenager is not really a relationship, is it? But, you know, go to the cinema with your 10 other friends. And but it was just an infatuation that was completely formed in absence, in longing for him to notice me. In, you know, I blame a lot of it on Dawson's Creek. It was very much this will they, won't they nostalgic teenage romance. And I say in the book, my parents got together at 15. And they sat next to each other in art class, and my dad looked a bit like Rod Stewart, so my mum fancied him, and they've been like blissfully, sickeningly in love ever since, and they have this amazing relationship. So I think there was part of me that wanted to sort of emulate that. And yeah, it's so difficult to describe, because I look at it now and I'm so... it's difficult for me to understand what I was basing the attraction on, because there was just not much of a real relationship. But yeah, we would sort of get together every year. I mean, have you heard the Taylor Swift song, "Tis the Damn Season"?
Of course I have. I'm so pleased you brought Taylor Swift up first, because I was going to do a whole thing about that later, but let's get into it now.
The best way I can describe it to you is it's "Tis the Damn Season." You know, every Christmas, we live in kind of villages next door to each other, we would kind of get together then, spend time together, and then we'd go off to our universities, lose touch, have other partners, and then, you know, when I would be bored or lonely, I get back in touch, and vice versa. But it was just, it felt like we were always circling each other, but nothing really ever came together. And I think that was part of the obsession and fascination for me, because it's much easier to romanticize something when you've never spent any time in it. And I'm sure if we have actually got together and had a proper year-long relationship, it would have been pretty rubbish and I would have maybe moved on. But it was just always the road not taken. Looks real good now. You know, it was just... And I think it was a lot to do with me. Like, that felt like home. You know, when you're growing up and things are a bit... scary and confusing, like, I just always go back to that, because it was, you know, I was in love with him before I even started my period. You know, it felt like something that was so childlike and then teenage and deeply rooted in me, that I just felt comforting to keep returning to it.
Yeah, I think maybe there's something about those childlike crushes that, because they start when you're so young, they're always, you always attach those young feelings to it. And so that's why it's always like, you can't ever move past it, because, you know, you mentioned Dawson's Creek. I'm thinking of, like, for me, it would have been like, oh, like One Tree Hill or some stupid show like that. And it's just like, there's always that really meaningful will they, won't they thing. And I've written about this a lot because I'm kind of fascinated by the way that popular culture to this day romanticizes and fetishizes that dynamic, which is actually really toxic. And it can be really toxic, like in normal people. For example, you know, it's neither of those two characters really end up very happy, and they're just circling each other. But because it's this will they, won't they dynamic, it's like you attach so much more meaning to it. Mm. And I think that can be really dangerous. And it can, you know, for me, this kind of infatuation obsession I had, it stopped me from dating anyone when I was at uni and really doing anything, because I was just still holding on to, oh, but he sent this message last week and, you know, maybe he'll send me another one. It just sounds so stupid, but you hang on to it. And that's what I mean about the childlike stuff, you know, it is quite childlike.
And the kind of most interesting things I obviously, when I'm having the conversation with that chat, I'm like trying to figure out what I was doing and why this happened. And the two things that were really interesting is, one, a psychotherapist called Frank Tallis had said to me, when we don't have any evidence of real intimacy, we call it profound. We, you know, I used to be like, I love him in my bones. You know, it would be something that was sort of mystical and magnetic. And he said, that is a big sign that there isn't really any intimacy there, because we almost haven't got any concrete evidence to latch onto. So we say it must be profound, it must be fate, it must be chemistry. But actually, that's sort of one false inference feeding another. Mm. And then the second thing, I can't know for sure if this was going on with me, but Philippa Perry talked about this thing called erotic mutual transference, where there might be somebody who, like, the way they push their hair off their forehead was similar to the way your mum did or your dad did or your nanny did. And so even though you're not aware of it, subconsciously, you're drawn to that because it's from almost a memory you are not even conscious of yourself. So it's sort of so deep within you, you're just drawn to it. And I wonder if there was something in that as well.
Yeah. So that's really interesting, because the Jack guy, God, poor guy. I mean, honestly, I've brought him up so much in
my promotion. Is his name Jack?
No. But like, I've brought him up so much in the promotional stuff for the book. And I just like, we're friends. I saw him a few weeks ago. I'm like, poor guy, he's gonna hate this if he's listening to it. But he lived really close to me when I was a kid, when I was growing up. Mm. We lived in the same area in London. And I think that was a part, that was a big part for me of why I clung on to it so much, because I was like, there was something really deeply familiar there. Mm. Because he actually lived around the corner from me. You know, none of my friends lived in this particular pocket of London. And because of that, there was like a level of, I don't know, perceived intimacy on my part and some sort of like perceived history. And I know that, you know, not too long ago, I dated a guy who lived in the part of London where I grew up in. Mm. And I that was definitely something that I could feel like subconsciously drew me to him. Mm. So that's definitely something I think worth like examining for sure. You said, you know, with Ben, he lived really close to you as well.
Yeah, 5 minutes away, and it's in the middle of the countryside, so that, you know, there are not many other people living around there. I'm so torn, because I think it's natural, isn't it? And it's, you know, the reason that we're obsessed with it is from Call Me By Your Name. You know, it is a kind of rite of passage, beautiful moment in your life if you can sort of leave it there. And I don't, you know, people say, oh, would you just take that away? And I wouldn't, because there was something beautiful about it as a teenager. And, you know, maybe we just should be allowed to love so intensely and live in our imagination. And we have so much time on our hands that it's only natural perhaps we do that. My issue was just, I didn't leave it behind. And I could have done with like maybe using a quarter of the time that I did and pouring some of that energy into other things. So I don't regret it completely, but I do regret how long it ran for.
Mm. And so it ended when you were 29, 30. was there a trigger to how it kind of came to an end? Was it that you met your now husband?
I was still in contact with him when I met my husband, but we were kind of, I mean, I say friends. I don't know if you have a same thing. I think you can often like trick yourself into thinking we're friends, but it's not really a friendship. You're in touch and you're kind of keeping in contact, but it wasn't really friends, but I guess we were sort of texting every now and again. But for me, I think it was a cliche, but approaching my 30s, I just became tired of the same patterns and the same, you know, trying to repeat the same things again and again. And I think I bored myself and probably my friends. And you get to that point where, God, I can't believe this is the this has been 15 years. And, you know, looking back on message threads and sort of shaking myself out of it a bit and thinking, what are you doing? Mm. And I do think, you know, when I met my husband, I was still really immature and I still was sort of in that game playing phase. I put on Instagram the other day when I played him the Joni Mitchell song and said like, oh, isn't Will You Take Me As I Am strung out on another man the most romantic thing? And he was just like, no, it's not romantic. he's so kind of simple in terms of just replying to messages straight away and just very much calling me on any bullshit or games that I would try to play. And I just suppose there was no longer a need or space in my life to try and keep that going. But I think it's a combination of age and experience. You can kind of only fool yourself for so long. I don't know. What was it for you? It's hard to answer because I don't know, but it wasn't a dramatic moment that suddenly I was like, oh, cured of this.
No, it wasn't dramatic for me either. It was sort of just, I think getting older and I think also, I don't know, I think maybe even doing the podcast and actually becoming more conscious of it and how absurd it was and how much it was driving me insane and how much it was inhibiting me. And then, you know, I started, because I didn't really date anyone properly until I was 23. And so I think it was then I started dating and that kind of shook me out of it a bit. And then I met my boyfriend a few months later when I was 24. And then, I think I just grew out of it, I think. But it's funny. And like, you know, when I was writing that chapter, I sort of tapped back into all of those feelings again and it felt very present.
Mm.
And it's only, I don't know, I think it's only when it's only in retrospect and I look at it now and I'm like, yeah, I'm over it and it's fine. You know, I love what you say in the book about all forms of love not being given or acquired, but being learned and earned. Because I think so many of us are kind of reared on this idea that love is something, like you said, just happens to us and people just fall in love with us and it makes it this passive thing that, you know, we think will complete us as a person. So when do you think you came to understand love differently from that? Was it when you met your husband, do you think, that it kind of shook you out of that way of thinking?
No, well, there's a bit, I write about my 30th birthday and how I really was just desperate to have a boyfriend to take to this. Like it became this real obsession thinking, you know, as it grew closer, I was like, I'll just take anyone from the app and I'll take them along to my 30th birthday. How insane is that? It would be like my family, my friends who I've known for decades, and then some random guy off happened that I met the week before. But for me, it just felt at the time like some sort of failure to not have found a relationship by then, which is so ridiculous now, but you build these things up in
your head. No, I think a lot of people feel like that. It's the pressure, especially for women, it's the pressure of turning 30. I mean, I know that's something that I worry about as well, and I'm just like, and I don't know why, and I know it's stupid, and this is the thing, I can recognize it,
yeah,
but this is the difference. Like, you can, you know, I talk about love, I write about love, as do you. I know all the things, I don't know all the things, but I know quite a lot of the things, but that doesn't mean that I still don't fall victim to them all the time. And the only difference is I can recognize myself doing it.
Well, my mum even said to me at the time, oh, well, you know, they had put a lot of effort and she was making all these like balloons and flowers. And she was like, oh, it's like your wedding. And I think that she was like, you're not probably going to have a wedding, so we'll just make this your wedding.
Oh, God.
There was just an expectation that maybe this would be a different kind of milestone. But I did, and Ben was there in a friendship capacity as well. But it turned out to be a really romantic night, and just one of those, you know, I just have been searching for something. And I just sat there and thought, I don't want to be anywhere else. I'm not checking my phone under the table. I feel so content and I feel so lucky. And I never thought that I would feel that way without a romantic partner. Mm. So that was a real moment that I kind of tried to think back on, you know, when I did go back to that place again. And also just falling in love with friends in my 20s, as a lot of people are lucky enough to, and getting to know my parents as an adult. You know, I think like in my early 20s, again, everything about my relationships and love was so egotistical. It was like, when will I find love? When will I find someone to love me? When will I find someone to look at me in a certain way? It wasn't, how can I be more curious about my parents now that I'm not so dependent on them? And how can I make time for old school friends who I might have lost touch with at university? Or, you know, I think my love story is my friends, family, and with myself. I had a lot of time to work on those things in my late 20s. Mm. And, you know, I don't think that work is a job should be a form of love, but I did switch careers and start to become a writer and journalist for the first time. And I had a sense of purpose that felt like a form of love in my life at that time too. So I think it was a combination of all those things, but specifically with romantic love. Yeah. Being in a relationship and doing the, particularly I'd say after about 2 years, when a different kind of relationship begins, it was just made me realize how much, you know, I had thought of maybe getting married as like the finishing line in my immature way of looking at things. And I just realized that it was a beginning, and it was such a privilege to get to try at something this complicated and this challenging. And I have found like every year, I suppose that has been one of the biggest things that has surprised me. I thought that long-term love was this sort of friendship, companionship, safe thing where you know everything about each other and it's kind of cozy and familiar. But I have found long-term romantic love to be so mysterious and erotic, and just it surprises me at every turn. I mean, my husband is like much sillier than the way I describe him in the book, and he's just very funny and not too serious. And he like left me a poem on the kitchen counter the other day, and it was really serious. Actually, I think I might post it on Conversations Love, because it's kind of sums up the book. But I just thought, who are you? Like, where has this come from? I kind of knew he wrote some poems, but there's this side of him that I hadn't seen in a while that I sort of forget about, and things like that. Someone can surprise you after 6 years together.
Which is so sweet. Lovely. What does he think of the book?
It's funny. When I'd send him bits saying, oh, are you okay with this? He'd be like, oh, the comma's in the wrong place. He's obsessed with grammar. I was like, yeah.
So is my boyfriend.
Yeah, I was like, are you okay about the fact that I wrote about us masturbating? He's like, oh, yes, semicolon. So I feel very
That's
lucky.
So funny. I have to tell you a story. So there was a bit in the book where I'm not going to say which bit, but there's a bit in the book where I'm kind of like doing a bit of speech. And there's a bit where I'm like, you know, he said something like this, and I sent him this little section to be like, what do you think of this? And he used the pseudonym and was like, well, I think it's very good, but I don't think is going to be very happy with this, because I don't think is the kind of man who would say this and do a splice comma. I don't think uses splice commas. So actually, I think you should change that.
That's so funny.
It was like, of all the things, I love that. That's so funny.
Yeah. And do you know, I think it takes, if I had been writing about certain men that I had dated in detail, they maybe, would have been more concerned with their egos, and they might have, certainly like men in the past have been a bit more funny about that. But I think Dan is very generous and not, he hasn't got a big ego. And so I think he, yeah, I was like continually surprised by how generous he was. And there was actually nothing that he had said no or asked me to take out. There, it was more me censoring and like maybe protecting us than the other way around.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're writing some sentences, and there's like particularly a fight when we're really drunk that I wrote that was very delicate to write. And I felt like as I was writing it, I'm kind of skating quite close to what I'm willing to share. But I want to go right as to the edge as far as I can go, because that's what makes it good. But it's just, yeah, you know where you can kind of push it to.
Yeah, that's the thing about writing about your own life, because I think often the things that resonate with people the most are the things when you are the most raw and the most vulnerable and when you share the most. But obviously it's not just your experience then, and you're involving other people, so you do have to be quite careful about it and the way that you do it. And I think the way that I've always tried to go about it is just write exclusively from, well, this is how it made me feel and this is how it happened, as opposed to, you know, some sort of, when you're talking about someone who has behaved badly and you're being like, well, they did this and then they did that, and like accusing them. It's not some sort of like vengeance exercise.
Well, I think my book was not that at all, because annoyingly, as I found about love, often I was a lot more responsible for things than maybe I might have thought. I think if I had written my book in my 20s, I would have thought, oh, these men treated me badly or this. But now I just see a lot more clearly how I was guilty of idealizing them, which is like a lovely place to be as a person, where I was, you know, more driven by ego than getting to know. So I just kind of, annoyingly, a lot of stuff in love comes down to like self-possession and self-sufficiency. So you realize that mostly it's on you.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it is mostly on me, but there have been some rascals, but they're not in the book. Well, one or two of them are, but they deserve to be called rascals, but it's not. And I always think you have to be careful, because like if you're writing about something and you haven't processed it yet and you haven't like had time to kind of look back on it retrospectively, then you're not going to write about it well, and you're not going to write about it with a full sense of understanding. So I think there are some things I have purposefully left out of the book because I'm still processing them, and I don't think I could write about them effectively or fairly, because maybe I haven't come to the realization of my own part, the part I played in the things that happened. You know what I mean?
See, I know that that's the advice, but I have done the opposite of that to the close, because the first section of the book, Finding Love, obviously I am looking back at dating disasters and all that stuff. But the middle section of my book, which is kind of, and the last section, which is over 2 years of my life, I was writing it as I was living it. So I left it like that. But there are some moments when I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm like, can I even write this? Because I don't want someone to ask me about this when I'm doing press for the book, if it goes wrong, or all these things. So I did what you're not meant to do, but I hope that it kind of has ended up like taking the reader on the journey as I was going on it.
And talk to me a bit, because I love your honesty when you write about the love for your daughter, and obviously that is very recent because, as you mentioned, your daughter is 9 months old. So you wrote at the end of the book how it wasn't exactly like love at first sight with her, and that's something that I think a lot of people really don't talk about enough. But I think it's probably a really common experience. So can you explain what you meant by that?
It's funny, isn't it, that we expect to fall in love at first sight with our children, even though we know that it would be unrealistic with a partner, or even with a friend. But yeah, I certainly had that, especially because I obviously am writing about love. I thought, oh my God, I don't feel this like gushing. And I did, my husband did feel that. And you know, I had been on so many drugs and had had, as many people do, a pretty rough labor. And I remember saying to Dan, I think my neck is broken. And I was like vomiting on myself. You know, it's not, obviously my neck wasn't broken, but I was so high on all these drugs.
Yeah.
And I just felt like I was just so focused on the fact that there was like someone stitching me up, and I was just in such a mess. I felt so broken that I don't think I had space in that emotion to be like, this is the best moment of my life. I was like, I feel like I've just been in a car accident. And I'm just, there's just so much to take in all at once. So I felt like a rush of like giddy connection to her and like devotion to her, but it wasn't love in the way that I understand it to be now. And, you know, as I said, like, I'm not surprised at that at all now, because love is a choice and something we learn and something that we grow into. And I didn't feel too worried about it in the weeks home, because I had interviewed a writer called Mira Jacob who had told me the same thing. And she said it was actually beautiful to have this falling in love with a child. And we don't talk about falling in love with our children. We talk about falling in love with people. But with a kid, it's meant to be like, oh, instant, like a spark. But my experience has been that a real falling in love. And I'm so glad it happened that way, because it feels like I'm falling in love with her, a person, rather than just this, a baby, because I've had a baby and that's what you're meant to do as a mother. And I didn't feel any shame about that, because I had heard that story. So that's kind of why I wanted to write that. So hopefully other women who might be feeling that pressure when they've just, you know, been cut open or whatever, know that that is really normal. And
yeah.
Even, you know, I certainly love her so much more now than I even did like 3 months in, because you start to see, you know, in the beginning, they can't make eye contact with you. They don't smile. There's like a lack of response. And then when you start getting them smiling at you, laughing, looking you in the eye, of course that deepens love, because you feel like, oh, we can interact. So yeah, I'm actually writing about that, and I think it's good for us to be more honest about it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure that will resonate with so many women. I think it's just, we do fetishize that, don't we? It's just like, oh, instant. It's the same with romantic love in a way. Not that, you know, like you said, you don't fall in love at first sight, but it's just like there's all this stuff that we've been told about what that experience is supposed to be, that when it happens to you and you don't feel like how you think you're supposed to, you feel so isolated and so sort of ashamed that you don't feel like that in a way. And actually it's much more common than we think. It's just people aren't talking about it enough.
Well, also I never knew how many drugs you are pumped for. Like, I never felt so high in a horrible way. It was awful. And just shaking, vomiting over myself, having people like chucking bloody rags as they're shouting, there's not enough time to get a surgery, stitch her up now. One man like stitching my vagina. You know, I can't, it's not an easy experience. So the fact that we talk about that as this blissful, like, kiss on the wedding day moment, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that.
No, it's hardcore. I have a friend that's had a baby, and she's told me all the gory details.
And it's like love. There's Lucy Calaniti said, like, she always used to think, like, the kiss on the wedding day was the romantic bit. But it's, for her now, she's lost her husband, and she kind of was with him while he was sick, and they went on that journey together. And for her, it's more about the fact that those people are deciding to stand there and be there when the other person's in hospital and be there when the other one's throwing up on a Sunday morning through sickness and health. And just like having a baby, for me, it's the quiet, like the other Sunday morning, my Dan and Joni were just asleep next to me in bed. And it was just this boring Sunday. And I just looked over at them and felt just never more in love. And it's just those quiet moments in a relationship, in friendships, in family. And I guess that's what I wanted to do justice to. And also because I didn't expect to fall pregnant when I was writing the book. And I kind of had, you know, much like you, I'm sure you didn't expect to fall in love while you were writing yours. And I had this ending planned about uncertainty and not knowing. And it was really important to me to say, even though I had this baby, it's made my relationship really hard in terms of romantic relationship suffering. And I wanted to say, yes, I'm so happy and this is amazing. But of course, that is another beginning of new challenges and different ways that love are going to kind of come in and out of my life. And I'll have to adjust the way I prioritize to different bits of it.
I'm aware that we've done 40 minutes already.
Yeah.
Natasha has very kindly said that she wants to ask me some questions about my book, as we've both written about love. So if you have any questions you want to ask me, fire away.
So I'm turning this into a conversation on love.
Turn the tables.
So I wanted to ask you, so you were falling in love as you were writing the book? Is that how the timings happened?
So it's a little complicated. Anyway, I started writing the book and then we actually broke up when I was writing the book. In July last summer, and then we got back together in September, and then we broke up again in February for 2 weeks, and then we got back together.
Wow.
So it was quite tumultuous, and it was interesting in the sense that it did change my perspective on certain things I had written about in the book, because I'd never gone through a big breakup before. Which sounds silly considering I've written a book all about relationships and never gone through a big breakup before, but it really informed my writing, because then as I was writing about, I was rereading chapters I'd done on social media stalking and WhatsApp and read receipts and stuff, and I realized how much I was checking up on my ex and how ashamed I felt of that. And I just, you know, I would block him on everything, but then I would find myself Googling his profile just to check what he was up to another way without actually unblocking him and just doing it that way so that he wouldn't know. And I went to very bizarre lengths to kind of feed my curiosity. And so I ended up putting all of that in the book, and it just opened my eyes to a few things that I hadn't, because I hadn't experienced them. And, you know, previously I was telling those experiences through the lens of my podcast guests. But then when I went through them myself, it changed my perspective on a lot of things.
So, and that's the person you're in a relationship with now? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had a tumultuous beginning. And do you think where you are approaching the relationship now, what have you learned from writing the book that might help you in this stage of the relationship?
I think the stuff that you've written about actually have and really prioritizing the effort that you have to make, and how that, you know, it's you choose that person every day and you have to actively work on it every single day. You know, relationships are not smooth sailing, and you have to adapt to things, and you have to learn to compromise. It's such basic stuff, but you have to actively make that decision to be in a relationship every day. You can't just let it happen, because that's when you get complacent and that's when things start to fall apart a bit. And I think also trying to learn that, you know, every argument doesn't mean that it doesn't have to be this cataclysmic thing. Like, you can actually have really healthy outcomes from arguments, and it can be a really positive thing if you just learn to communicate effectively with one another. And I think communication is probably the most important thing I've learned in relationships, because, and this is funny in the book, because I think when you're dating someone in the early stages, it's really hard to communicate authentically with someone, because you're doing it through all of these channels that are inherently inauthentic and come with all of these extra anxieties of, you know, seeing when someone's online and seeing when someone's ignoring you. And I have to try and not get bogged down by that even now in my relationship, because it's just, I just think the way that these platforms are designed, it's so toxic to your brain. I think it can, it's designed to just exacerbate your anxieties.
Do you feel in a way, because obviously a lot of the relationship stuff you had similar to me is like the issues around not being yourself and withholding. Is there a way in which, because you put all this out there in the book and he's read it, that there is a level of intimacy and or just ease with which, or freedom from telling him all these stories and being very honest about who you are and your relationship?
Definitely. Definitely, because I would have thought that none of what I'd written would be surprising to him and that he knew all of it already. But actually, I think he read it and kind of took a lot from it and realized that there was a lot that he didn't necessarily know about me and the way that my brain worked. And I think it has been really helpful in that way. I mean, he's been a real trooper. It's not easy. You know, I've written about a lot of other men in the book, so it's not been easy. And, you know, I've written like promotional pieces as well for other publications that have been about different people. So he's been a real trooper about it. He hasn't really, if he has concerns, he hasn't raised them with me. He's been very, very mellow about it all. So I'm very grateful for that.
See, I think I would find it fascinating, or maybe I wouldn't in practice. I always say to him, I was like, I want to know I'm almost, you know, I'm sad that I didn't know this first part of his life. And I'm like, tell me about this relationship. What happened in this one? And why did this one?
I don't want to know. I don't want to know really that fascinating. Stuff.
I think when you get to a point where you've been together so long, yeah. I certainly remember in the early stages feeling a bit intimidated about X or something. But when you have got to a stage where it doesn't feel like that much of a big deal, I certainly am more intrigued. But Dan has no interest in my ex-love. I think it was surprising for him, who knows me as like a very confident person who is obviously writes about love and very interested in understanding, and to read about some of the experiences where I did like shrink myself and sort of disappear in relationships. I think he's just like, this is so different to you. Which I guess is the whole point, isn't it? You become different people, and then
yeah. And also if you are shrinking yourself, it's obviously a sign that you're not with the person you're supposed to be with. But that's what I always used to do with the men I dated. I never felt like I could just be myself and be, you know, a bit silly and a bit strange and a bit like, you know, irrational and mercurial as I can be sometimes.
But I don't think that is about you're with the wrong people, because I used to think that too. And now I understand, you know, Philippa Perry said this in her conversation where she's like, no one is right for anyone. There isn't like the right shaped person out there for you, emotionally shaped. She's like, the work of a relationship is you doing that together, getting to know each other, changing for each other, not too much, but compromising. And now I'm not saying that all the relationships I had in my 20s would have worked out if I was a little bit more honest, but I do think there are certainly some, the reason that they failed isn't because they were the wrong person, I was the wrong person. It was because we weren't doing the work of being in a relationship together.
Right.
On both sides.
I see what you mean. It's an interesting way to think about it, because I would look at that and be like, well, there's a level of incompatibility there. But I guess it's about whether you blame that on the individual or the connection of the two of you.
And I guess it's not about who that person is. It's more how much they want to be in the relationship.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, I guess I don't really believe in types anymore.
No, me neither. But I also think, a lot of the time what goes wrong in relationships is people don't realize what they want. And so someone, you know, like you said, someone will enter into a relationship and thinking that they want a serious relationship and they want to settle down with someone. But actually, subconsciously, they don't really want to be in a relationship. And that will manifest slowly and slowly until they come to that realization. And that's only natural, I guess, because you have to have a degree of self-awareness to know exactly what you want. And, you know, I'm still figuring that out. And I wrote that in the book at the end, in the last chapter. You know, I was obviously asked to write a conclusion, and I wasn't going to come away thinking, well, this is everything I know and I'm all settled now and now I can go off and just be really knowledgeable and wise about love. It was very much like, I'm still learning every single day. It's a work in progress. I'm still learning about what I want, the kind of person I am, the kind of partner I am, the kind of partner I want. Like, I think it's an ongoing process. You don't ever stop, I don't think, do you?
No, and I think out. With every year you realize you know even less.
Yeah, exactly, because it becomes more complicated. And then obviously when you have children into the mix, it brings a whole other thing.
And I feel I try to capture this, it's almost like things are tipping in different directions each year. And I certainly felt like in my 20s, my friendships were so easy. And I would say, why is getting into romantic relationships so impossible and so kind of anxiety inducing? And friendship is so blissful and romantic and easy. And, you know, we didn't even have to arrange things because we lived together and it was just this beautifully easy thing. For me now, friendship is so much more complex and painful in ways that we have to allow each other to change. And lots of my friends have lost parents. A lot of them are in fertility struggles. Some have got relationship issues. There's just, or sick parents. There's so much more pressure in different ways. And also we don't live close by. And so, every decade or, you know, even every year, I think there is like a new set of challenges thrown into the mix.
I was talking to a friend about the friendship thing the other day, because I think friendships do actually become much more complex as you get older, and they become, you know, relationships I think are always pretty hard, but I think friendships get increasingly harder as you get older, because like you said, there's that distance thing. You won't be as close physically as you were to each other as you go older. People get partners, people move away, things happen, and people change. And often I don't think allow ourselves room for change within friendships. We think that, you know, if we've been friends with someone for X amount of time, we have to always have them in our lives. And, you know, obviously what ends up happening is you get older and people change and people grow apart. But I think it can be really hard to accept that. And because you just want to cling on to it, and you don't want to admit that you're losing someone from your life who was really important to you. But it's just actually, it's a natural part of life, and you change and you move on, and you're not necessarily as compatible as you once were.
Or you are compatible and you just have to accept that there's a few years where you've got to kind of trust in the friendship more and not see each other as much, and you'll come together again at a later point.
Yeah, or it changes, because it's not as easy as it was when you were at school and you had lunch with them every day and you saw them after school every day. It's just, or at uni when you live with them, it's different. It's tricky.
I interviewed a psychotherapist the other day who said, obviously we don't have like a narrative arc for friendships in the same way as we do for romantic relationships societally, as in like, I don't know, engagement, moving in together, boyfriend and girlfriend labels, marriage, or if you want any of those things. And she said there is something beautiful about that because we have so much more freedom within them and we all crave freedom. So that is a beautiful part of friendship, but it also means that it's the easiest thing to drop off because we're not kind of bound to it in the same way, and it's easier to walk away from it or neglect it. And she said to me, and she's a mother, she said sometimes it has to be as important as eating, as drinking. And I hadn't heard someone talk about that as friendship. You know, we talk a lot about mum guilt and we talk a lot about prioritizing partners and all these things. And I think that friendship, you know, lots of people I've interviewed have said, oh, I'm ashamed to say this, but when I want a career, family, partner, friendship does take a hit. And I don't know why that is the case. You know, it shouldn't be the case. And I think all things will have to take a hit at different times. And we just need to make sure that sometimes we are saying that friendship is as important as motherhood, or as important as work, or as important as everything else. So yeah, I was grateful for her saying that, because it made me think, no, sometimes that has to be at the top of the list, because if it's always at the bottom of the list, then it's going to fade.
So it's time for our Lessons in Love segment. So this is where I ask every guest on the show to tell me something they've learned from their relationship experiences. I feel like out of all of my guests, Natasha, you probably have the most lessons. So since you've literally written a book pretty much about lessons in love. So yeah, no pressure.
Gosh, there's so... Can I have two?
Yes, you can have two.
So I've learned so many different things, but I think specifically in romantic love, I wish I had known to tolerate the mystery in another person and how actually that could be a gift rather than a burden as they continue to surprise you decade by decade. But I guess the bigger lesson overall is just how expansive love can be and how many different places you can find it. I'd always look for it in one place, which was in the arms of a partner. And I have found it in nature, in purpose, in friendship, in strangers, in so many different forms and shapes and sizes. And I feel when you can see love in this way, you find more of it. Like the more places you look for it, the more you find it. And now I think I am much better at not just waiting to find love, but creating it. And I wish I'd done that sooner.
I love that so much. I particularly love that you've included nature in that, because I find in the last year with the pandemic, obviously we've had so much taken from us, and one of the joys that hasn't been taken from us is spending time outside and just engaging with our natural world a bit more and appreciating, you know, our local area. And I don't know, I went wild swimming the other day and it was just so lovely. Just, you have these little moments, and I think it's important to cherish those and recognize that they can give you that sense of fulfillment and that same sense of kind of validation, I guess, in a way sometimes.
And the biggest, I include that because the biggest lesson from my book was, and the reason why I wanted to interview lots of different people, is to try and pull back from my own love story in order to remind myself that we're all connected and parts of something much bigger. And I think that nature is one way we do that. And my journey in love certainly has been getting, you know, I start from like really looking in, and where I'm at now is trying to look out much more about how I can be loving and how I can give love to people in my life. And that has, you know, another thing is like loving someone, it is as rewarding as being loved. And I never contemplated that. It's been really rewarding.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener to this show, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or anywhere else. You can comment and leave us a rating too, so that more people can find us. Keep up to date with everything to do with the show on Instagram. Just search Millennial Love. And my book, Millennial Love, which is based on the podcast, is out now with Fourth Estate, and you can buy it at all good bookshops. See you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.